This is a Pinball News production.
We can start a very short history of me in the pinball industry. Actually, we can start now. I started in 1979, back in the 20th century, by lucking into a job at a small company called Game Plan. And the Game Plan was a maker of cocktail pinball machines. I don't know if anybody's familiar with them. I'm sure there are some still hanging around somewhere. But they're such a joy to work in. And I was basically testing the games, going through them one by one, and make sure they ran, adjusted the play field components if need be. And one thing led to another there. It was very strange. I went and brought in some artwork that I had done. And I caught some people's attention in the engineering section. He says, how would you like to do artwork for a game coming up? And, of course, why pay an artist if we got one in-house? So that's basically what it was. They were a very budget-conscious company, being a small industry. And I said, of course, you know, would I rather work in the factory or go play artist? Oh, I said, let's try artist for a while. And they gave me a nice little spot in engineering, and I created the artwork for Global Warfare, which they made a whole 10 of. And that was their adventure into the wide body pinball, too. It was, I guess, co-designed between Roger Sharp and Ed Cibula. And Roger has one, and I don't know where the other nine are. They're around somewhere. So after that, while I was doing that, I was also passing on suggestions on the current model being produced. And now we changed over from cocktail pinball, also cocktail pinball, but also now full upright machines. And they produced Sharpshooter, Coney Island, Pinball Lizard, and a number of other games. And with my, proactive, that's it. Being proactive about it, I got my foot in the door. And they says, the gentleman in charge of engineering, Ed Cibula, asked me if I'd like to learn how to make these. And I says, sure, why not? Let's go. And that's what happened. And from then on, I worked on a game there. Unfortunately, they didn't get around to producing it until years after I left the company, because they decided to get out of pinball, which shoved me into a job opportunity at Gottlieb. So it was kind of being in the right place at the right time. I switched over to Gottlieb, not that easily either. I went in and did an interview and was the second person hired for a single job. So I got lucky there too. A couple years later, Game Plan came out with Attila the Hun, which was the game I had laid out for them. But my first production game came out of Gottlieb. That was Rocky, and followed by a number of other games. Spirit, I haven't seen one here. But the old wide-body Gottliebs, they did nothing but wide-bodies in the beginning. Worked there until Coca-Cola bought the company. Coca-Cola changed it into what they thought was an avant-garde video game company called Milestar. And we were able to make pinball machines only because we kept the factory open and people working. Because other than a few minor scores, they didn't do too well at the video end of it. They inherited Qbert. They inherited, I don't want to give them credit for Mach 3, but it was the Laserdisc. And that was a huge success in the beginning. And then when the Laserdisc players started to fail, that was the end of that. Everybody just shut those down. It's unfortunate, but technology wasn't there. They probably could do it today with a DVD, because they're not as temperamental as lasers were. From there, they've decided to close it up when the profits didn't roll in the second year. And fortunately, one of the distributors, Mondial Distribution, decided to invest in pinball. And he, Siren Fesjan, and Gil Pollack, who was the vice president of design and engineering at Gottlieb, formed a partnership and became Premier Technology. And we started over again. And the we were lucky enough to be able to have all that hardware behind us, because we had a very good hardware system. They were very reliable. Gottlieb games lasted forever. Premier came and went, and I did a number of games with them. And like all good things, it was just time to go at one point. So I left the Premier and took up an opportunity with Williams. And then I stayed with Williams until they decided to shut down pinball. And then everybody went in the street. And, well, at least the pinball people did. And from there on, I bounced around trying to keep my fingers in pinball somehow or other, even if it was just on my own. The opportunities that did arise were varied and strange. I did have an opportunity to go to ICE, which is basically a redemption company. They're out just outside of Buffalo. And they wanted to make pinball machines, so they talked me into moving there. And I spent a couple of years there. But after a short while, they decided not to make pinball. And I got to make an alley roller redemption machine called Duncan Alien. So if you ever see that in Chuck E. Cheese, I did that. But that was the only claim to fame I had on that. It's not the same as pinball. It's the reward isn't as great as pinball is, because you actually get to watch the game proceed in pinball. It's a different animal. On redemption games, there's very little involved. It's how fast can I take your quarter, pretty much. And I'll give you two tickets. You get a million tickets, you go get a comb or a pair of sunglasses. And which is fine. The kids love it. Oh, look at all the tickets I got. And there's a place for that, too. So after I did that for a while, I went back. I moved to Pennsylvania and with a friend there, and I got a job working for it was called Thermo Electron, and they made autopsy tables out of stainless steel, which was a lot of fun to design, but he didn't want to get involved with it too much. And some of the guys had to go from there on installs into New York City and stuff. I said, nah, I'm going to pass on it. So I didn't ever have to go. But that was kind of an interesting job. Unfortunately, it was just a temporary job. In the meantime, my friend over here hooked me up with, was it Fox Sports Entertainment? Right, and they wanted somebody that actually designed pinball machines to design them a play field for their promotion for the 2004 for five. It was the All-Star game that was on in, it was in Detroit, right.
And I'll be showing that.
The video? Okay, good. You can see the end product. So I designed them a play field. Oh, it's gorgeous. Wait till you see it. It's very good. They liked what I did, and I of course, designed them a game that I would hope to build one of these days. It's all done in SolidWorks, which is my software of choice now, and it's very rewarding to see things actually get built in front of you, and you can turn it around and see how things fit. And it's much better than, a 2D dimensional platform. So after that, I was invited for a seminar in the UK outside of London, and I said, of course, I'll take the appearance. Went there, got hooked up with a couple of fans that really wanted to make their own pinball machine. They had done one, but it wasn't. It was someone there had designed it for them, one of the guys in the group. And it was a nice little machine. It wasn't real spectacular or anything, but it worked. So they asked me if I would be interested in doing it. And I said, of course. So it's still 8 years later and still getting done. If you look up Forbidden Planet Pinball, there's pictures of it on the internet. And it's operational, kind of. So it makes it to the shows out in their area, and one of these days I thought I'd come by and see how it actually plays.
I played it 2 weeks ago.
Oh, did you? Yeah. Was it working? Pretty good. Yeah. It's an interesting game. I hope you liked it, because it's just a one-off, and then there won't be any more. I look at the bill of material for that game, and it's just astronomical. It was just like, oh, let's do this. Oh, let's do that. Of course, you can do one of anything like that, but don't you can't get it to production. And along the way, I was approached by George Gomez, who was the vice president of engineering at Stern, and he offered me a job. And I says, George, I had known George from before. We had worked at Williams together, and I had seen him at Premiere a few times. I said, of course, I'll come on board. And so I've been there for the last 3 years and enjoying myself tremendously. I never thought I'd be able to get back into pinball, but it's someplace once you get in, it's like in your blood. And you enjoy doing what you do. You don't feel like you're getting up to go to work every day. You can get up and go to play for the most part. There's politics everywhere, though. So that's the downside of any position. You have to work with other people. Anyhow, that's pretty much my career in a nutshell. If there's anything from anyone, I would love to be able to sit here and do a Q&A with the audience tonight, and possibly again tomorrow. So if anybody's got any questions for me, all right, Jim.
I don't know why I don't remember this, but tell me about demons and about how they appeared on the play field.
Yeah.
Video, but how did that work?
Demons was an experiment that I did it when I was at, I'm not sure if that was Gottlieb or Milestar at the point, but I wanted to project three-dimensional objects onto the play field, and you do that with kind of like they did with Pinball 2000. There's a mirror, of course, and you see through the mirror, you see the play field, but you also get the reflection of whatever's above it, and I was able to put little ghosts dancing on the play field. And
when was this?
I want to say late 80s, okay. Sometimes. And Jim was gracious enough to put feature it in his magazine at the time. And there's an issue back there with, what was it called? Ghost, not Ghostbusters. Ghost Chaser, maybe, or something like that. I think that's what it was. It had a different head to it. Didn't have the normal back box head, because I had to bring the play field up and over, and you see the reflection. So there were two play fields, essentially, that looked like one. Yes?
So I have a Judge Dredd, I love it. What's the story behind that license, and how did that come about? Because it's not an American license.
No, it's not. I'm off again, on again, comic book collector. And I pretty much had the entire run of 80, 2000, and Judge Dredd comic books. And I just love the irony of the violence, the gratuitous violence that was in that magazine. It was a funny magazine, you know, because it was overboard. And it was done really well. It just happened to be coming out of England. So when the opportunity came up, was actually when they were thinking about doing the movie with Stallone. And so I had already asked for the license, and they said, well, what would you rather do, the movie, you know, tie it into the movie. And I passed. I says, no, I would rather be true to the comic book, and we'll keep it that way. And I think I did the right, I made the right choice on that. And that was just a fun game to do also. That one came right after Creature from the Black Lagoon. So I had pretty much the same design team in on that. And our bent sense of humor was also in that one. Did you ever get the guy falling off the tower and you hit the button? No, you hit the flipper buttons after he falls and the dog comes out and does his thing on him. It was just a little fun little Easter eggs like that that we got to put in the games. Oh, yeah. I haven't seen the dog in color yet, but I'm sure it does. I love those color DMDs. It looks great on Creature, too. I think that they have one here, and it's really good looking.
So any relation to Demolition Man?
Demolition Man was done by Dennis Nordman, friend of mine, another co-designer at Williams.
Yeah. Similar ramps?
I don't see it. No, I didn't even put jet bumpers in that game in Dread. And Steve Ritchie, my friend, always comes and tells me, how dare you not put jet bumpers in a game? Facetiously, of course, but we're good friends. We now have offices next to each other. I'm in the middle. Steve's on one side, John Borg's on the other side. So we do. There's a lot of cross-pollination there, too.
You got shaves yet, or still paper?
Still paper.
How long has it
been?
A year. We've been there over a year. For security, rather than have nothing, because that's exactly what they have on the other side. When you come into the new building, the if you go one way, it's the offices, and if you go the other way, it's engineering. And we got nice offices in engineering, but I have a little flap cut out of my brown paper. That's my window. But I have to make sure I tape it up at night, so we keep our security inviolate. Yeah?
Of course, when you were at Premier, did you work on the ice fever, being Canadian and the hockey?
Of course. No, and you'll find my name on the back cover of the manual. Because it was frowned upon to put our names on games. The whole Gottlieb legacy was that way. Nobody's got their name on them.
Yeah, I thought it was really well done.
Yeah, ice fevers.
Other than the Bobby Orr, I mean, you haven't seen too many.
No. And or baseball games either, because basically you're not going to sell many baseball games to Europe.
Yeah.
So I got to do the Chicago Cubs, which is such a great thrill for me. they've been the only major league ball team that has been licensed as a pinball. And then my last game there was Silver Slugger, pretty much, that I had full control over, and happened to be another baseball game. Sure. Anybody? Yes, Martin.
You've designed wide-body games, you've designed regular-body games, you've designed cocktail games. What's the best shape for a pinball play field?
I think what we're doing right now, it's the old 20-and-a-quarter wide play field. It, from the positioning of the flippers at the bottom of the play field, which Steve Kordick was responsible for doing, it opened up a whole fan on an array of shots, and it's beautiful. Going wide body for me is a challenge because the shots aren't really that addressable on the outside, so you have to make them kind of sloppy. You put a maybe a target bank there, so you hit a target, you're doing well, and all the action is straight up the center. The last wide body was Judge Dredd that I did, and If you look at the layout, most of the shots are standard shots where the ramps are positioned and everything. Yep.
Are we going to talk about Ghostbusters now?
Well, if you like. There's nothing really to talk about. It was
start from the very beginning.
Oh, I can't even remember the very beginning of it. It was just like a franchise. Yeah, it was a franchise that I had asked for. And my third game in, finally, they said, okay, let's do Ghostbusters. I says, you're not going to be you're not going to be sorry you did this, because this has a universal appeal. It appeals to women, it appeals to guys, it appeals to the young, the old. Everybody loves it. And all you'd have to do is go to anybody and ask, who are you going to call? And everybody knows the answer. So it's an iconic piece. Starting in on it, I enjoyed laying the game out and talking with Dwight Sullivan, who was the lead programmer on the game, and he came up with some really cool rules for it. And from our meetings, we would just write everything on the whiteboard and all our ideas, and then try to organize them. And it came out real nice. Yeah. No, but there was not much to it. The first Whitewood was almost right. There was a short target bank in the middle that I had put in. Right now, there's a single target and a captive ball that ended up there. The target bank I had designed in there was on an arc with a series of small targets. But what happened there is the ball would hit that and shoot to the left side and clunk into the ramp, into the ball guide rail. It was just like a bad shot. So to change it, I have to change the angle of the rebound. So a nice big fat target for you to hit, and then that turned into the slimer target, and then the little captive ball to get all those symmetrical book stacking books going. Yeah?
I missed the first part, but what was your favorite game to design?
Oh, that's tough. Right now it's Ghostbusters. It's Ghostbusters. Ghostbusters is probably a Creature from the Black Lagoon. And after that, there are so many other ones that I really, really enjoyed doing. Judge Dredd was one. There was that magic moment there at Williams where everything seemed to be rolling in the right direction. I did enjoy doing Congo, believe it or not. Everybody hated that theme. It went around the engineering. Okay, who wants to do Congo? And everybody said, no, I'm going to pass. And it went around twice, and he says, well, you're up next. You're doing Congo. So that's the way I got to do it. So sometimes it gets dumped on you. Sometimes you get something you like. And that's the way it is. That's business. And what else did we do? Flintstones, that was a lot of fun, too. Got to go out to the quarry. We did, actually. They built bedrock on a quarry, and it was a lot of fun to see.
How would you compare today designing a game, the time that you had to complete the rule set versus 25, 30 years ago?
When I was working at Gottlieb, things were pretty easy, a nice schedule, but the games were a lot less complex. Basically single-level games. There were a few at ramps, but not too many at the time. That was Black Hole, Haunted House, Spirit. That's the only ones I can remember from that went up and down. And so the process was a good, maybe 9 months or so, which is currently what we have. Ideally, we have a nine-month schedule right now. With three designers, we're able to rotate through production and give us a nice long lead time in. The rules are becoming just more and more deep, more complex, and sharing the assets at Stern is not like the dedicated assets we had at Williams. And so if we had a team, that was the team's responsibility. That was all they had to do. So consequently, we got a more complete game out at the end of that nine-month cycle, or sometimes it was a year. It depends upon who you were and what you needed.
Were you involved after the game was released?
Oh, sure. Yeah. You know, even after we released the game, we were looking for bugs, especially in software, things that just didn't work out right on the physical layout. But by then, we're pretty much locked down as far as that's concerned. We'll find ball hang-ups here and there that we'll add a piece of plastic to or a post just to knock the ball down. But pretty much the game's ready to go. Yes.
You touched on something. I've talked to a lot of people who I'm trying to introduce pinball to, the newer kids and like the early 30s, and they're saying it's just too busy on the playing field. How do you compare that? Would you rather go back to solid state and EM where you have a smaller defined plate?
Well, you know, Stern's...
A lot of people find it too busy.
Yeah, I understand there's been that complaint for a while. Or a comment, I should say, rather than complain. But Stern is also trying to do this ELG, which is a small game that's basically for the home, and it's fairly simple. And it's getting really mixed reviews right now. So they're I believe they're going to try another relaunch of that that option for people. It's being sold like at Costco and places like that.
What do you prefer, then?
The pin, right, yeah.
What do you prefer, EM, solid state?
Well, I'm a child of the solid state. When I came in 79, they were already in the solid state. So, yeah, I love the sound of the electromechanicals is cool, and I enjoy playing them. When I find a wood rail, I'll go play it just to see what it was about. And a number of years ago, I went to... the Pacific Pinball Expo, which I don't believe they have anymore. And they had someone's entire wood rail collection. It had to be at least 40 or 50 machines there. It was an amazing amount. I'm sorry? Okay, yeah, it was just... there were things I had never seen before. This is when pinball was growing. This was evolving. It had games without flippers that the bottom row of post would just jump, and that was your control on pushing the ball back into play. It was a lot of fun to see. And then was it last year? I think it was at Pinball Pinagogo in California. Also, they had dedicated a room for just the electromechanical stuff. So, which was really nice. It's like you just step back 30 years when you walked into this room, because all you hear was...
My son's friends over, they go to the ENs before they go
game. Because they're less threatening.
Yeah. It's the sound. Oh, wait a minute. What's that sound? Where nowadays it's all digital.
Yeah.
Kids are like, whoa, wait a minute.
Every time you see a TV show or a movie with a pinball machine in it, what do you hear? Jing, 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 jing. Jing, jing, jing. Yeah.
Even with... Mustang.
Anything. Yeah.
Yeah.
It sounds, they have the EM sounds. It's just perceived stuff. Yes?
So kind of along the lines, as a designer, now that the rule sets are super deep and super complex, there's still only so much you can put on a playfield. So how has that changed, or what do you do, how do you think differently than, you know, when... You know, there wasn't modes, and you know, does that constrain you, or does it open it up? To
I think making anything more complex usually it does some constraining, but the work has to be done before the game gets put together. So those are brainstorming sessions that we sit in when we've got a theme and we've got ideas. And we got a big whiteboard that's empty, and we just start writing. And usually it's the lead programmer that's doing the writing, because he's going to have to make the program. So I sit in on it, and we all, you know, agree to disagree, or we have ideas, and we'll make a big list and then try to organize the list, which is where I'm at now with my next game.
Do you much change while they develop or program?
Oh, sure.
I mean, so they say, you know, this works for 6 modes, but it doesn't work for 8, and I've got an idea for 8 modes, you know, and so I need something else here to make that.
Not the physicality of the game probably wouldn't change, but we could readdress the dedication of some features.
But you're not going back and redesigning
the playfield? Probably not. We've agreed on basically right now. They like to have toys, so Ghostbusters has its share. And I was so pleased the way the Pro came out, because I design LEs. I figure it's easier to go and pull things out than to add things in, and it looks like Band-Aids. Then to me, it does anyhow. So what you see on the premium here is basically the game that I designed. And then we started taking things out to make it more cost-effective to get a pro out. And the reverse ramp on the pro is the same shot as the little helical ramp on the premium, but it goes backwards. And that was George Gomez's idea. So, you know, I'm not adverse to anybody expressing themselves. He says, why don't you try going backwards on the ramp? And I says, hey, that's a good idea. Let's do that. So we threw the switches in. And we got two shots using the same ramp.
What do you think of non-themed pinball?
Oh, I love them. Non-licensed pinball, I love it. There's three guys at Stern right now that would chomp at any non-licensed opportunity. Slim and none, probably, right. For the immediate future. You know, they have a winning formula, and pinball is still kind of shaky. It's not as big as it used to be. It's getting better, definitely getting better. We've got places that are looking for the machines now instead of not looking for the machines. So, yeah, but possibly. I'm not going to say definitely not.
We could use another hockey team.
Yeah. Yeah, it's something like that. Yeah, that was sad. That was sad. I remember seeing him play for Detroit. Walter.
Yeah, there's been so many incredible marquee brands and things like that. Why was there never, for instance, a Battlestar Galactica pinball? Well, how do they finally choose what they actually go with?
That's a good question, really. But I think it's the availability is number one, and the appeal of the license. Battlestar Galactica would have been a great one. But it just never came around. I don't know why.
Was that because of Stern or because of more?
Oh, no. Well, Battlestar, of course, was back in the 70s. You know,
the new series.
The newer one.
The new rig. Yeah. I'm not saying it can't be in the future. Yeah. But there are there are priorities now because we've only got three designers. And it's not like there's a whole lot of companies. The other companies out there are doing their best, and that's great. I'm glad to see competition because that means the product is spreading. But their turnover is not as great as Stern's is right now.
How many games a year do you try to put out Stern?
Every 9 months. My cycle is 9 months, so there's three games a year usually. And it can go a little bit plus or minus, too, depending upon. Hopefully, we'll let the Ghostbusters run for a while. That'll be nice to get a real easy machine. Go ahead, Walt. Let him follow up. No, I don't know.
My big bad tradition with video games, when I see the prices and value of video games go up, maybe someone can answer this. Why are pinballs costing $4,000, $6,000,
$8,000,
and $10,000?
Yeah. Your distributor probably can. You could probably work something out with them.
Well, you know, the most valuable, expensive, collectible pinball of a video game might only be $2,000 or $3,000 or $4,000.
Right. It's the mechanicalness of it, pretty much. It's a labor that changes for every model. The entire thing, there's nothing we can pre-design except maybe mechanisms like drop targets or stand-up targets.
Collectible. It seems that a very collectible pinball is going to be way more valuable than a very collectible video game. But I've pondered why that happens.
I don't know. Is it supply and demand? There's, you know, like a collectible video game. Maybe they made 20,000 video games. I'm not sure what the numbers were back then, but there's only one pinball that made 20,000 units. That was Adam's Family.
There's no moving parts in video games.
Well, and that's it. You know, you put a monitor in, you got a control panel and a marquee.
Well, the wedge heads which are basically all the same, and you change the play field.
Well, the play field's where all the labor is.
Yeah.
I know that there's a larger number of people, I think, that are buying video games, pinball. But yet it seems that...
video games can only be implemented on another platform.
And nowadays, especially, they've got some great home systems that the game companies in the 90s were actually just straight out developing for the home, and they weren't even going to the arcades at that point. They were just working right for the PS and the PlayStations and the other units that I'm not. Yeah, exactly. And you had a good monitor to run it up on.
Do you have any idea what percentage of new pinballs go to collectors and not operated?
Another good question. No, I don't. Not really. I would guess that the LEs are the collectors, pretty much. Although the premiums and some pros go to some collections, but I think that's what the LE is designed to hit, the home collector. And it's got all the bells and whistles on it. So it's something they can take home. I don't see too many LEs out on location. And now it's nice to see games on location again.
So in designing Ghostbusters, what was your favorite little bit that you came up with that went in there? It's like, yeah, that's
fun.
That's the bit that I made.
Well, I enjoy the Ecto goggles. And, you know, this is just a little throw-in almost. And it's like Pinball 2000 in miniature. Yeah. There is a nod to my recently deceased pet, my cat. And the black cat shows up every once in a while on the display. So that was the one. There are a lot of things that came from other games that I had designed and never finished. The magnetic slingshots were one that was on my next game up at Williams and never made production. So I had the design, the idea that back then, and finally got a chance to do it. And we actually had made the prototype slings, and we worked out most of the bugs pretty much over a year before we went into Ghostbusters, and just to see if it was going to work or not. And it worked. We actually had to change the level of the rubber ring because the standard level of it lofted the ball with the magnet. So we pulled it up on the second ringlet on the posts and used the longer posts, and it works fine. Yes?
Starting from go back and look at, you know, since most of these games now are kind of the software as far as driving the game, do they ever go back and look at say, older games and go, you know, hey, can we add content from this license? You know, say, like with Star Trek, you know, the new movie's coming out. Do they ever go back and look at that and go, you know, maybe we can add content to this?
If we would go back and add content, it wouldn't be to an old playfield because they're pretty much dedicated. We have all the instructions needed printed out on the boards. And
design process, do you guys pretty much have everything mapped out as far as your vision for a game?
Sure, yeah.
And, like when you first start, or does that evolve?
Well, the physical layout evolves as it gets going. It's, you know, it's a couple of month, 3 month process of just doing the layout of the game.
I'm just curious, like Ghostbusters, is there features in Ghostbusters that haven't been added software wise?
Yes, but they're coming. there's one big surprise that's coming too. I can't wait for it. It's not in there yet, but it all, of course not. But then it would ruin the surprise. I'm sorry, new rev? I don't know, honestly. Dwight's working on another game, of course. So everybody's working on other things too, but also trying to wrap up that. He's working with, I believe he's working with Steve on his next game. Yes, sir.
A couple of questions.
Yeah.
What was the game at Williams that you were working on that never got done?
And okay.
Where did the moniker Dr. Flash come from?
Okay, first question was the game I was working on was called Aces Escape from the Bermuda Triangle. And I got as far as the layout. We had a little mechanism that was going to rotate different planes that would bank left or right on the play field when you lock the ball up, and I moved the display down to the back panel, and it was going to be like a video game, if you were. and flying different missions through time. There'd be biplanes, there'd be jets, there'd be planes from World War II, and that was the idea behind the game. As far as artwork was concerned, we made a real preliminary sketch of the cabinet with the, from Kevin O'Connor. I think that's been put up on the pinball site somewhere. And it's just, that's as far as it got. And that one had the magnetic slings in it. Yeah. And the skill shot showed up on Forbidden Planet. That skill shot, the little sneaky skill shot I have in that one, that was from that game too. Dr. Flash was the moniker that was given to me by Python Angelo because we were working on what turned out to be two games at the same time. We did the Williams Bride of Pinbot, and we did Bally's Bugs Bunny. And he says, you know, you are just flashy. You had to know him the way he would talk in his Romanian English. So the Dr. Flash came about from him. Because we worked nice and quick together, and we spent a lot of times at the was it the Metro Club? That's what it was. But we actually worked too. Yes.
Can you for later describe if any nightmare stories working with licensors?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh yeah. Lately. Yeah. After Mustang, I was asked to do another game that shall remain nameless, only because we may go back to these people in the future and, you know, have a working relationship. But the theme wasn't one of my strong themes. But irregardless, they came around when it came time to do the artwork and wanted to direct it with an extremely heavy hand and wanted it to look like a piece of artwork, literally. Nothing like a pinball machine. And we wouldn't bite. We had already put 5-6 months of development time into this theme, and it just went in the drain. And it happens. You know, you don't plan for it, you don't hope for it, but it happens. So now we've got to turn around and flip something really quick. What are we going to do? We got a, you know, a production schedule to keep, and our marketing fellow says, "Well, we got one that we can turn around real fast," and that was WWE, because they're very enthusiastic about getting a pinball machine done. And I said, "Well, if that's what we got, that's what we got." So I went back, and Dr. Flash came to the rescue. And turned out a play field that was fairly unique for the game. It came out pretty good. Well, I was actually able to get, you know, 2-3 levels out of the game out of one piece of wood, because the upper levels cut out of the bottom level, and then I just put a piece of metal on top for the rollovers. Yeah, that was a nightmare.
Is there any possibility of resurrecting that table at some point? I mean, like.
Yeah, there's always that possibility, but I don't like to go back. My design is specific to the theme, pretty much, and that one was very specific. So there were features on there that just wouldn't translate. So and usually you get a better game if you dedicate your design to the theme of the game. You can, you know, create features like the magnetic slings I was able to pull in. Slimer on his little post down there, and you can see the differences in this one. On the Pro, it just comes up and down, and on the LE or the Premium, he moves back and forth, so he's a little harder to hit too. Yeah, Walter.
Has there ever been a time when any pinball manufacturers toyed around with politics, like creating a Donald Trump?
Yeah, that would be something. Well, they used to, when I started at Game Plan, they were licensing. That's how the cocktail pinball machine came about. They were actually doing licenses for Black Velvet, Camel Lights, and that was the theme on the playfield. So it was an advertising motif, and they got their production going like that. And then later on, they re-arted the same play fields for a more pinball-oriented audience. It turned into Star Trip and Family Fun. It was the same play field.
Wouldn't a politician, wouldn't sort of be a little bit of a coup if Donald Trump's organization?
Yeah, I understand what you mean, buddy.
Approach you guys and said, we want 100 units, we want Hillary Clinton pinball.
Well, yeah. Yeah, right. Well, maybe a video game, but a gun game might be better. No, I don't think that.
Reynolds and Marx has a good Clinton statement.
It probably does. I don't remember. That's the video, the 2000 one? Okay, yeah. You can get little jokes in on that politician. The problem is the politicians, the jokes, or even the dedicated game is so transient, you know. So 6 months down the line, you go, who's that? You know, right? It could be a Dukakis pinball. Who? Yeah, nobody would even remember who he was. The people being interviewed nowadays, they don't even know who the vice president is. Oh, yeah. It's shameful, actually.
When a pinball machine's released, it becomes more valuable and more valuable. What was your biggest surprise in terms of the pinball that came out of Stern and Rattle from your work that then became super valuable? What took you by surprise?
Just about every one of them, to be honest with you. Yeah, no, because I'm not working in a closet, but I'm not as aware of the reception that a game gets as people in marketing would be, say. But I hope it does well, and I hope we sell a ton of them. And I think the celebrity, like me standing up here or sitting up here right now, talking to everybody about my life in pinball is crazy. I'm just an average person with a not so average job. Yes, sir.
Was making Ghostbusters extremely hard?
Was it hard? No, it wasn't too hard. I had a lot of great people working with me. We have a team of people assembled. One person is assigned to be the leader of the mechanical end of it. He makes all the little things that work. One person is assigned to be the artist. We even have another person that comes in and does all the sculpts for all the three-dimensional pieces, like the library, the cities, and the Slimer little guy. He does that, and then of course we have the programmer, and then we have me. I get to do the layout of the game. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Slimer's wearing like a piece of chicken or something.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's a chicken leg or a turkey leg, whatever he managed to pull out. And we were debating whether to make it a turkey leg or a bottle of wine. And I says, oh, let's make it a turkey leg. It's a little, it's easier. It's fun. You would expect him because all he's doing is eating in the movies. You know, so he's crazy. I wanted hot dogs originally, and it turned into a turkey leg, which was fine. Yes, sir.
The hardest part about the Ghostbusters?
The hardest part is getting Slimer to work. There's a pressure-sensitive type switch and mechanism inside there that is hard to adjust correctly. And so some games are a little different than others. Some of the games you really have to nail the target. Other games you can just brush against it. Some of them get too sensitive, and all you have to do is shake the game and he scores. So we have to, there's a fine adjustment, and that was the most difficult thing on Ghostbusters. And also I had to make sure that the ball came up back up in the LE and premium version from when it dives below the play field. If you notice, the ramp shot is in the same spot on both games, but it goes up way much higher on the LE and premium versions because it needs to be that high to make it back out the other side. That was the first thing George, who's my boss, he's the vice president, he says, does it have to be that high? I says, watch. And we had made the prototype, and I put the ball at the top of the hill, and it came out. And I put the ball 1 inch lower down the side of the hill, and it didn't come out. So it has to be that high. Just, I don't know, what do you call that, kinetics, physics, right? The inertia of the mass has to be yada, yada, yada. Anyhow, I just knew it didn't work. Huh? Sorry?
It is what it is.
Yeah, it is what it is. But then we got very creative down there, and it became very expensive down there because we have the diverter, and there's a three-ball lock, and then there's a post to release that, and then and there's another kicker there to kick the ball out. No, but, yeah, so the sculptor has a lot of fun doing it. And just to get the proof of the city. Well, that's not my game. Neither is that. Yeah, that was the first library. It got tapered and pushed back a little bit. Maybe you can see New York Public Library written on the front of, across the front of it. These sculpts were done in foam. And this was the first prototype. You see the five bank in the middle, in back of the Slammer target? That's what changed. That it just didn't work. So when I have more than one person come and tell me it doesn't work, then I seriously look at it and redesign that area. The rest of it pretty much stayed the same.
What's that in the background of the picture?
Yeah, right.
Assembly.
I don't know. Let me see. Pan up. Pan up. You mean all the way over there?
Yeah.
That's a kiss.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because they were showing, when they were working on the kiss, they had some pictures put out. This was in the background. But but without anything on it. It was just a white one. We had just got it in. And there were some people going, were asking, what's that? And somebody got their hand slapped for that. And these, yeah, they're all foam. So it's really nice to be able to pick these. Are this is a multi-piece construction, and you can just pick it off and move it there, you know, cut it off, make them shorter. Originally, Slimer was supposed to come all the way from behind the fire station. Can you go back to the other one, Jerry?
Sure.
The fire station on the left, I had him hidden behind there originally. He would make the whole orbit around and come down and run back and forth on the playfield. But we decided to just make it easier just to put them up in the city. Because getting over that ramp was a potential problem. Okay, one more.
John wanted to make it look like he was, like, moving in the city, kind of?
Yeah, it could be. Yeah, but he hides in there. The lights go off on him. Because we have nice green lights on top of him and light him up real good when he comes out. Yes?
So I recognize there's a certain perfection to the in-lane sling flipper position that's made. That's everyone all kind of. You ever think about or toy with?
This one isn't. This one's different. I made this one brutal. Yeah, this one's different.
Oh, you mean
the Ghostbusters?
Yeah,
the layout.
Did you ever think about changing that bottom plate?
Well, yeah, everybody is very comfortable with the two flippers next to each other. What we've done in the past is move them over left and right in order to gain some area on the play field on one side or the other. This one, I decided to see if I can get six lanes coming into the expressway pretty much, and I was able to because I eliminated the wooden sticks pretty much. Is that there's a metal piece on both ends, and I was able to get three lanes on both sides. And then I was worried about getting balls in all six lanes, too. So the ramps feed back to the inner lane, which is the hardest one to get. And if you catch a ball and cradle it, it'll run back up the outer lane. And or boom, boom, and maybe out. Yes.
I'm not sure if you answered this before or not, but I was wondering what the reason is you prefer to have flippers a little bit further apart than most others.
To me, it gives more. Actually, we're still getting only a third of our drains through the flippers, which is basically average, even on this game. And what I want to do is bring that post on the outlanes into play a little more. So right now, everybody just, you either open it up or you close it up, and hopefully there's no real ulterior motive other than that, just to try something. And this one just turned out to be right for this game. It's a brutal game.
So your goal is trying to get a 30% chance of draining left or right?
Probably, yeah. I think that's what the ideal product would be, a three minute game too. And most of the games are testing at 3 minutes or just under that we have out on test. So, and there are a billion games, not a billion games, a billion score on the games coming out. So somebody's beating the hell out of it. And even though the flippers are a little wider, but I always get static for that. Yeah.
Do you personally like the multiple flipper games, or do you just like two?
That's a good question. We get a lot of grief internally for that multiple flipper games. They management doesn't seem to like. They say people don't understand that flipper on the right on the side, or the flipper on the left on the side. And if you watch people play, they're right. Only the pinball player puts those into play and really enjoys them. So consequently, they're not in every game, and it's not a big priority for me to either put them in or take them out. If the game calls for it, yeah, I'll put it in. There's no problem for me putting a side flipper in. They add another dimension to the game. Do I like them more? Yeah, if the game is right for it. I like that on the Flintstones. The Flintstones had three nice shots on that side flipper. And that's why, Judge Dredd's another one. Judge Dredd had four because it had the long loop around, and then it had the little flipper on the right side that did the short loop. You could sit there and beat on that, too. So that was a kind of a loopy game. Yeah, but I like them both. I think I would, if I had the right layout, I prefer using the flipper than not using the flipper. Yes?
So that kind of brings up a good question. When you design a game, how much of what you think actually goes in the game? Do you have 100% control? Do you have 90% control? Or?
Well, I like to think I have 100%. Yeah, pretty much that too. And I've learned designing the LE is the best way to get in there. So when it's so far over budget, and I've put in things that, I could live without them, and I pull them out, I just save them $150, and they're all happy.
Yeah, have you ever gone all the way and say, I insist on this because I know it's right?
It usually ends up on the LE now. Okay. Yeah.
A couple back when you worked for Williams and everybody.
They were very good about it. The only one that I can recall that didn't make it was the gorilla on the Congo game. Actually, was designed originally to come up out of the play field and spin around left and right, and you would capture him or kill him by shooting at his back. There was going to be a target. The sculpt is the same. We just put it down there and made it pretty much static, left and right, just bounced the ball around. But that was huge as far as cost was concerned, dragging that whole motor up and down.
If there were LEs then, would that have been on the LE, do you think, or still?
No, I think it was just too much. But I pushed the envelope. Yes, Walter.
John, can you recall what was the most expensive single feature you ever put on the game?
That was probably it, but it didn't make it. Yeah, the one that was coming out of the board. That sculpt, incidentally, was actually done by Stan Winston. We were having trouble getting it right, and he says, just send me what was called the armature. And the armature is where the sculpt is made on. And we just sent it to him, and he did the whole thing over and sent it back to us just free. He says he just wanted it to look right. The most expensive thing that I've gotten away with is possibly the Black Rose Cannon. That's a pretty large toy. It encompasses the motor back and forth and a catapult inside it.
What about rotating handle?
It was a nice piece. It came out real good. It wasn't that expensive, though. Yeah. It has the Geneva gear and a couple of kickers that probably would have ended up in the game somewhere anyhow. Yeah.
Who usually had the same ideas as you? Who would agree with you more out of all of your company?
The contemporary, who would agree with me more is probably all the pinball layout people. Steve Ritchie and John Borg would always agree with me because I agree with them. I'll scratch your back, you scratch my back. Yes.
Out of your personal collection, what is your favorite game?
I have no pinballs at home. They turned into dust collectors for me. You know, I play them for a little while, and my passion in this is designing the game. I love to design the game. I love to see it put together and get finished. But when the game is finished and it's in production, I'm pretty much finished with it. I'm done with it. I'm looking forward to doing the next one.
So what do you collect?
Comic books. I play guitar. I sing in a band. That's my other thing. Action figures, you know, a little bit of everything. Oh, I did have Amazing Fantasy 15 for a while, and I had the first Fantastic Four. Golden Age, I was never lucky enough to find a stash. You know, I had a few old Detective Comics, but nothing. A lot of the 50s EC comics, the Tales from the Crypt and Weird Science, Weird Fantasy. Those are great stuff. I love the artwork in that. Wally Wood.
So going back to, since you don't have any pins at home, if you're out and about and you see one, it's like, oh, I've got to stop and play this. Is there a title that catches your attention like that?
Something I haven't seen in a while, usually, because everything else I see at the shows.
What have you played here?
Let's see. I'm trying to remember now. The Mystery Castle. Because I don't see that one too often. There is? Yeah. And a couple of the EMs. That's me. Go ahead, guess.
You mentioned there's slim to none chance of an unlicensed thing, but what about classic Stern? Maybe not B's or classic Stern
remakes? Well, that's pretty much what they call the vault editions now, and it's not going back real far. Because everything for the Vault games exists still. And it would be hard to go back too far. And you'd just be remaking the game from scratch pretty much. Because some of the parts are not ready for production. They have to go back and order everything. That's the thing about pinball. It's very labor intensive. And you can't get away from that. For every game it's going to be different, unfortunately. Yes?
Ideas from your life and how
it ends. Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it probably could. My life isn't that much, isn't that spectacular, so. Yeah, I understand. I get it. Because I've worked for a living, too. I was out of pinball almost as long as I was in pinball after the layoff in the 90s. I didn't get back in until 3 years ago with Stern. Other than my trying to keep my foot in the door any place I could. But as an actual means of putting bread on the table, that was it. 95, 96, somewhere in there. I forget when the layoffs were. And then I came back 3 years ago. That was 12, 13, somewhere in there. It was a long interruption there. Yes.
As a designer, how much power do you have on the art itself? Can you veto the art? Do you have control of the art?
Yeah, pretty much. I like to give everybody their head. These people are creative too. If I want something in the game, I will make a suggestion that early, and see how it goes. We get to see sketches first before we go anywhere with it. The Ghostbusters, there are three different back glasses, and they're basically the same back glass, but there's different features that are prominent on the different games. And I loved what he came up with. So having Jeremy do the artwork on my next game is going to be a plus for me, too. Yes, sir.
What do you think of the work Dutch Pinball have done with Brighter Pinball?
I love it. I finally got a chance to play it. Where was I? I was in Germany. Yeah, a couple of weeks ago. And, I finally got a chance to sit down and play it. And I really love it. It's really cool.
And are there any other of your designs you think would be suitable for that kind of treatment?
Well, you have to also remember that came from the alphanumeric displays. So that made a huge difference by putting that DMD in there. Color on top of it. It looks sensational, which I really like all the color DMD work. I think that's great. I would love to have had that in the game from the beginning. I don't know about another game. It would almost be like pick one. You know, and, from that, I guess that's the System 12, I think it's called. Or 11? Yeah, okay. Pick one. And if they gave it the treatment that way, a little bit of love and an enhancement more than a change of the game, which that is really. And they did real nice. And I think they could do that with other games too. And I think there's a market for it too, because if you pick out a game that everybody likes and you enhance it, it's not like you're destroying the original idea. So I really got to play it finally, and I played once in here and there, but I got to spend some time on it, and I really liked it. It's pretty cool. And maybe they've got all their software bugs out of it right then, too. Everybody has them. Oh, yes, sir?
How do you know when your design work is complete or finished?
When I run out of time. That's the hardest thing. No, but it's the truth, too. Okay, let's go, you know, and like you saw on the couple of slides we had up here, the change that has to be made will be made. But if everything else works out, and I'm usually pretty happy with what I come up with, I'm one of the few lucky people, I guess.
I mean, do you think games are done, or could you always do something?
No, there is a point where you're messing with success. And if you have an idea for a feature, keep it there. It'll show up in the next game possibly, or the following game. Or maybe not at all. Sometimes they just end up in the basement. Yes?
Do you have a particular, other than the gorilla, a particular design feature that's never made it to a machine, a favorite?
Well, up until now, it was the ramp that dove below the playfield, and now I finally got a chance to put it on, and the magnetic slings was another thing, and I got a chance to put them on this one too. So now I have to go back and stir up my idea bin and see what I can find for the next game. But no, that everything's pretty much gotten out the way I liked it.
Do you think the magnetic slings will make their ways to other tables? Like, is this where...
I don't know yet. I don't know yet. There's no cost benefit from putting them in. In fact, I think they might even be a little more expensive than the slingshots themselves. The jury's out yet. They work fine. On this game, it's fine. So we'll see if we can use it again. Because that's a big coil under there. That's the coil that was used on Lord of the Rings and Austin Powers to capture the ball in the center. So it's got a nice 4-inch diameter to it. That's a huge coil under there. What did we win?
I'm putting you on the spot, John.
You got my cards, huh?
People don't realize that when John got put into the Hall of Fame, this man here, he's a bigger genius than maybe you guys even realize, influenced us to make the whole series of the Pinball Hall of Fame trading cards.
Yeah. So you got a bunch of them, huh?
So I brought your card in to put you on the spot.
That's fine. Oh, no, I brought my Sharpies, too.
Everybody should have their card autographed before they leave the
room. Oh, that'll be fine. I brought flyers, too. I brought the premium flyers, so we can sign those for you, too. And if, okay. Go ahead.
How do you feel about the virtual pinball arcade?
You know, I'd like to enjoy that, but it's still just a video game. you know, it's. I think it needs more tactile feedback. Maybe if you got a control panel that you could hang on to, and it would give you feedback, like you could feel the things happening in the game on your hand somehow. That would probably be the turning point for me. But I think they look great.
I mean, do you think it's part of the reason for the resurgence, maybe?
I don't think it would hurt it. Yeah, it doesn't hurt it. The system for the virtual reality is not cheap either.
I'm just talking about just the iPad or...
Oh, okay. It kept the interest out there. You know, pinball was a thing, you know, although you hadn't seen one in a while. Yeah, because the 2000s were very pinball bleak is a good word. Yeah. Yes, sir.
Do you take like video games like Xbox, PlayStation, or do you like competition from those guys? Or?
Yeah, that's a different vehicle. Yeah, I think there's a place for video games too. Sure, that's fun. Yes.
What do you see in the future of pinball and pinball design?
Oh boy, that's tough. It's like, yeah, that's what it would be, a crystal ball. I don't know. The changes in the game within the last 20 years or so have been very small and incremental. We've gone from just a plain electronic readout to alphanumerics and then to the DMD. Now everybody's going into the LCD, and the changes on the play field, there's not too many. Physicality wise, you have to design something that works with the pinball. So that's your limitations, and the mass of a pinball can destroy things real fast, especially with the speed of the flippers now. So that's about it. Okay, yeah, good. Thank you all for coming, participating. Walter, you got the cards all ready? But I'd be happy to sit here and sign a card. I'm sorry? Oh, they have one. Okay. And I'll also sign a brochure for you if you like. Thank you very much.